Welcome to Maine Coast Dock Talk. I'm Ben Martens with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, and in this episode of the podcast, we've got an interview with two PhD candidates to chat with them about eDNA. This episode was recorded in the fall of 2022, making it over a year old at the time of publication. We had a little recording malfunction on my end, and so there was some extra work that went into cleaning it up, and honestly, it just took me forever to get it done. So I apologize to our two guests. Regardless of the timing, though, this was a great conversation about eDNA, what it is, how it can be used in fisheries management and science. We then got into an actual project that was done by students at the University of Maine, including our two guests, in the area that is set aside for development for offshore energy, a large wind turbine off of Monhegan Island. So we're able to learn a little bit about how this new technology and data collection process might be able to be used in a very real way close to home. So for more information about that project, a little bit of background on eDNA and what it is, we've got some information on our blog, along with a couple of really cool infographics that Emily and Asher and their team made for us. So go to our website, mainecoastfisherman.org, check out our blog or the podcast page. There's a lot of great stuff there. Thanks. Now on to the interview. I'm here with Emily Pierce and Alex Asher, and we are going to be talking about eDNA. And Emily and Alex are both at the Darlick Marine Center through UMaine. And so before we dive into eDNA, Emily, Alex, I'd like you to introduce yourself. So Emily, let's start with you. Who are you? What's your background? And how did you get involved in eDNA?
Sure. So hi, my name is Emily Pierce. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Maine, and I study environmental DNA for a living. I got started actually on the West Coast, where I studied things like abalone and mussels and tried to create some tools to detect them, and then ended up finding this really awesome PhD opportunity, moved across the United States to Maine, and ended up here.
Alex.
Yeah, I'm Alex Asher. I'm also a PhD candidate at UMaine, and I actually study lobster larvae. I got my degree in marine science at BU as an undergrad, and I told myself I am going to study larvae, and I will never, ever touch genetics. And then I came to UMaine for my PhD, and I started to work on lobster larvae, and somehow I got sucked into eDNA. Now I love it.
Most people know what DNA is, even if it's just from a murder mystery TV show, but what is eDNA?
eDNA stands for environmental DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid. It's genetic material that's shed into the environment by organisms when they poop, breathe, make babies, whatever they do. You're kind of like spewing off eDNA as you sit in your chair right now and are breathing. It's kind of like a cloud around you. We can use it to detect animals in soil, air, water, and even ice.
Why does that matter for our oceans and when we're thinking about marine sciences?
Well, so eDNA is almost like the perfect tool for the marine realm because water is so chock full of eDNA all the time, and it makes a really data-rich source for us to go in and see what is around in the ocean at different points in time and at different temperatures and different areas.
What are the constraints of how we can use eDNA in what we currently understand of it?
Sure. So I always make the joke that if you look at eDNA wrong, it breaks down. I would say the half-life, we're looking at a day on average, if that. If there's less light, if it's cooler, if the pH is at a certain level, it might last a little bit longer. But in general, we're finding a lot of it goes down very quickly.
Really, that's one of the many million-dollar questions in eDNA. How long is it there? Where is the best place to find it? And yeah, like Emily said, it could be a day. It can vary a lot, sometimes by organism, sometimes just by environment you're in. I think one thing that we're finding is that if you go to somewhere like sediment, you might find that it is trapped for much longer than it would be in the water column. It might be around more in cooler water than warmer water for a longer amount of time. But yeah, it's one of the questions that people are constantly chipping away at right now. I know that there is a project related to how long eDNA stays in the system that Maine eDNA is actually working on.
And in terms of constraints, there are plenty. I work specifically with invertebrate animals for my dissertation, and we're finding that if you take a green crab, right, an invasive crab here in Maine, and have it just sitting still in a tank, It doesn't shed that much eDNA, but if you make it run on a treadmill, it will shed a bunch of eDNA. So activity.
Quick pause. Hold on. Do you have treadmills for green crabs?
Yeah, we have an underwater treadmill that we can make crabs run on. It's actually kind of funny.
I don't appreciate you guys having workout regimes for these invasive species. I hope you don't put them back into the wild after getting stronger.
No, okay. Definitely. But, you know, it, like Alex mentioned, it really is a species by species and even environment by environment difference. And so it's like when we detect eDNA in a sample, some of the work in the laboratory is looking at what does that signal actually tell us? Is it telling us that there are 5 green crabs there? Is it telling us that there's 1 green crab and it's just like running around all over the place? Is that green crab reproducing? We're still working on those details.
Alex, as you're thinking about marine science, when you're thinking about stock assessments, when we're thinking about how we could actually use this new tool that's being developed in places like UMaine and around the world, what are the opportunities in fisheries and marine science?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the reasons that eDNA is taking off is that despite the difficulties, the constraints, and limitations, when applied correctly, eDNA can be super powerful and it can tell us a lot of information that would otherwise take us a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of difficulty to assess. So, you know, there are really kind of 2 basic ways of applying eDNA technology. One is called metabarcoding. And the other one is called a quantitative PCR or a qPCR. If you look at a string of DNA, all of our DNA is different, but there are certain sites that stay similar over time because they're really important to basic life processes like metabolism, just breathing in and out. You wouldn't want to make a whole lot of changes to that piece of DNA because then you cease to live properly. So those sites stay the same for a long amount of time over evolutionary history. It's going to be similar among lots of different taxa. So we can target those really similar sites in metabarcoding and use that to amplify variable regions that are specific to a taxa. So in a metabarcoding study, we can take one sample of water and pretty quickly assess just broadly what are the present species there. For instance, take a water sample out of the Gulf of Maine and say, on this day, what fish were in this area. And that can be a much quicker, easier way to do that than taking a net and dragging it through the water. And obviously it has less impact because we're not removing those fish. We're just removing genetic material. The other one, qPCR, is really targeted. It can be for just a specific species. And like I said, it's called quantitative PCR. And that's because it's the quantitative measure with a little bit of sort of setting up of your assay, your experiment. You can use a quantitative PCR to have actually a quantitative measure of how much of one specific species is in an area. So you can take that same water sample, instead of saying, what fish are here? Say, how many cod are here? What is the abundance of this fish species in particular in this water sample?
That's great. One of the biggest issues that we run into is we don't have the resources necessary to go out and do trawl surveys in all the different places in the Gulf of Maine when we are looking at stock assessments for a lot of important species. And then, you know, other species that we know very little about because they either don't come up in nets, right? Or we aren't doing trawl surveys in those areas. Inshore Gulf of Maine, really hard to get trawl surveys done because we have so many lobster traps in those areas. When I learned a little bit about eDNA and I talked to you guys, it was like, this is an interesting tool that we could start to deploy into the fisheries world. Emily, why don't you give a little bit of an overview of the work that you guys did on the area off of Monhegan using eDNA to look at the site where they're talking about putting an offshore wind research array?
Yeah. So what we did for our class project last fall in association with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association was we did a proof of concept study. So we went out to Monhegan Island, took water samples at 3 depths, one kind of near the surface, one in kind of the midwater area, and then one near the bottom, where they plan to put the wind platform and somewhere just outside where the wind platform will not be. And we did this metabarcoding that Alex just talked about, where we took the samples back to the lab, filtered the water onto a glorified coffee filter, collected the DNA that way, and then sent it off to the UMaine sequencing facility, where they use a primer called 12S My Fish, which is basically, you know, Alex was talking about how we look at certain parts of the genome. My Fish is part of the mitochondrial genome. And the purpose of doing that is that we can match those fish sequences with a database. So we sequenced these samples using the 12S MindFish primers and got back a whole bunch of fish sequences that we detected out at Monhegan Island.
Alex, what were some of the species that we saw?
A lot of species you would expect. Cod, there were cusk and flatfish. There are some that are a little bit surprising. We saw Atlantic salmon, and it's important to sort of note, there's one day, one sampling attempt, and one lab day of running all of this. So when you hear surprising things like there were salmon out by the Monhegan offshore wind farm site, it's one of those things where you're like, we should definitely double check that, you know, just to make sure that there really was salmon out there. Yeah, it was a lot of the fish they would expect to see, which was really heartening for us. Because if we sent in those samples and we got back the dolphin fish, I don't think there was a dolphin fish out at Monhegan, and I'm not sure that went very well. Or if we only got tuna, I would say there probably was other stuff other than tuna out there. But we got a nice array of very expected fish species. And also, you know, fish species that are important to fisheries as well as to the ecosystem.
You had a top of the water column sample, you had a midwater sample, and you had a bottom of the water column sample. The fish that popped in those different areas was interesting. Cod was something that was seen in the entire strata of the water column. And then the flatfish were in the mid and the bottom. Why would you be sampling at the different levels of the water column? And what does it mean that we saw cod, which tends to be a bottom dwelling species? Why was their DNA at the top? Is that just where they were, or was that what the water was doing that day? How do we start looking at this data and thinking about what it can tell us about what's happening in the area off of Monhegan or anywhere else that you would do this type of sampling work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, overall, what we found is we need more data. Like, this is really cool and it seems to work. But there are these questions like, why did we find so many flatfish kind of like in the midwater? Why were the cod everywhere? And these are questions that with just one day of sampling, we can only kind of guess why that would be. You know, one reason could be, like I said, eDNA is poop. And so maybe the poop were floating up. Or maybe there was some wind that day. The water was really well mixed. And so we can kind of use those data for present absence, but it's hard to say exactly like, oh, yes, there were cod all the way up and down the water column. Probably, you know, based on what we know about ecology, that wasn't necessarily true.
I think one of the pieces that's interesting is, yes, we're identifying cod in the top of the water column. That doesn't mean that cod's there, but it means that something related to cod was moved around through that area and was caught in the sample. When we have traditionally gone out and collected data on fish stocks, it's based upon seeing the fish. We are not seeing the fish with this data set. We're seeing an indicator of a species. And so that's where like, oh, we're seeing an indicator of a cod. That's interesting. We're seeing an indicator of a flounder. That's what you might expect in these areas. Swordfish, that was another one that popped up. It's like, well, those are usually much further offshore, but maybe there was one that was coming through. We have this new information. How do we use it? What can we use it for? And where can we take it into the future?
And I guess the moral story is, this is cool. We can use the data. We need more of it if we want to really, you know, tell a long-term story. Because you're right. Maybe somebody on a boat was eating fish. Maybe a whale came through and pooped. We don't really know. And so more long-term study is definitely important to answer those questions.
It's always good to apply a lens of common sense, especially when you have a very little amount of data when you're starting out.
Yeah, we are very interested in these types of data sets moving forward and thinking about, you know, if we're going to be doing large scale development or even small scale development in our oceans, that means that surveys are going to have to change, right? You cannot drag a net through a offshore wind array. You're not going to be able to do that. And so what type of work do we need to be doing now to set ourselves up for future success when it comes to data collection? How far off do you guys think we are in terms of understanding how to use this type of information in real world applied sciences?
Emily can correct me, but I think we're there. we're there in terms of what we can do. It takes time and money and it takes effort, but you know, Maine is a kind of a great place to be doing or wanting to do eDNA research right now, because we have a lot of resources through UMaine and Maine eDNA who are interested in promoting eDNA research and working with community partners and citizen scientists on eDNA projects. So I would say we're really there. It just takes the money and someone's interest and effort to put it into practice.
And I will say too, from a literature point of view, there are many studies, especially with FISH, where we're starting to piece these things together. Two examples that I can think of is there was one study in Europe where they compared deep sea fisheries trawls to eDNA data. And the only thing really that differed between the two was Greenland sharks. They weren't catching the Greenland sharks when they were doing their trawls, but they were finding the eDNA. Pretty much everything else was really consistent with abundances and like catch abundances and eDNA abundances. The other study that I think of is in the Great Lakes. They've had the Asian carp coming into the lakes and, you know, they started to detect the eDNA of the carps, but nobody was catching them. And so people were like, this is fake. This must be contamination from something else. And then finally an angler caught one and they were like, oh man, this really does work. So like Alex said, I think we're there. But I think we need long-term studies and we just need to be careful in making sure that, you know, if we are driving policy and conservation with eDNA, we do have the background, you know, laboratory science to back it up as well.
That's great. You guys pulled together a really pretty graphic that outlines the sampling that you did off of Monhegan. We're going to be putting that up onto our blog so people can take a look at that and dig into it. Just to put some bounds around that though, did you look at shellfish or marine mammals, or was this just looking at fish?
It was really focused on fish. You know, we talked about metabarcoding and how it can be used to look at broadly what's in a sample, but there are some constraints. It's tough to sample it across phylogenetically. In other words, it's hard to get a lot of good vertebrate versus invertebrate coverage using the same set of tools because they're so genetically different. Even though we have those conserved sites that should be fairly similar, a lobster is pretty far removed from a tuna fish, from a humpback whale. So we really try to focus in on those fishery species that are invertebrates. That's not to say that we couldn't also detect lobster, scallop, clam, humpback whale, anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say too, is that, you know, we still have these DNA samples. We didn't use all of it. So if funding were to be found, sure, we can look at mammals. We can look at invertebrates.
I just wanted to put some context around it because if you were to look at this and be like, oh, this is a snapshot of what was in the ocean that day, it's like, well, they're only seeing fish. No, this is because this is what you were looking for and what you were testing for. And that is not necessarily reflective of there's no human here. I'm sure there was some human DNA floating around in that ocean. So that's a great little caveat to put around what we were looking for, what we were testing for, kind of the bounds of some of the research projects that we were doing here. How much does it cost to run a sample through the process?
It depends on where you are getting your work done. If we're just thinking about sequencing, if you are sending out just a couple of samples, it'll be about $30 per sample just to sequence it. We sent out, I think, 46 samples, just our one day of sampling. If we're thinking just sort of practically, if we're trying to throw a price tag on this as like an ongoing thing, you can expect probably a price tag between $5,000 and $10,000-ish, maybe per sequencing day or per sampling day. But that's kind of trying to include, you know, the lab work and extracting the DNA. There are lots of different steps that are involved in going from a jar of water to a list of sequences and species that are in there. Each one has a price associated with it. Some is a little bit higher than others, but yeah, but that would be my back of the envelope estimate.
what's next for you guys? This was a great side project that you guys did for the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association as part of a class. What are you working on over the next year that's going to be moving eDNA forward?
So I'm in my third year at UMaine, which is crazy. I have 2 years left, and my dissertation focuses on invasive invertebrates. So basically, you know, if you're a fisherman, it's all the icky, squishy, crusty, slimy things that grow on the outside of your fisheries equipment. And I'm using the tools that we've talked about today, actually, quantitative PCR, so a single species study, and metabarcoding to see how they compare. So if I use metabarcoding, where again, I just send it all off, sequence everything, and figure it out, is that as good at telling us how many invasive species are present as a single species analysis? Or do we kind of need to do both in parallel? So that's mostly what I'm up to, is just figuring out what invertebrate eDNA is trying to tell us.
Yeah, so I'm in my, starting my fifth year and final year, if I have any say in it. And like I said, I mostly work with lobster larvae. And one of my lobster larval projects is trying to understand what lobster larvae eat, which seems like a really simple fundamental question. But when we're talking about, you know, really tiny little organisms like a larva, it can be really tough to understand exactly what they are eating out there. And that's where eDNA can come in. I've been doing this work first through just dissecting lobster larval stomachs. As it turns out, it's also pretty hard to identify something that has been eaten and then chewed up and digested by a lobster larva when it's already pretty small. So eDNA can kind of step in, and I can sample from the gut of a lobster larva and use metabarcoding to try to understand what was in that lobster larva gut. And then I can also use qPCR to do a more directed study of big species that I might be interested in to try to figure out if they are present in a lobster larval gut. And that'll help us understand what they're eating and help us kind of understand their ecology.
I love it. Thank you for taking some time today to walk us through eDNA. And we'll be putting some of the work that you did for the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association up on our blog. So thank you guys.
Maine Coast Doc Talk is a project of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, a fisheries-based nonprofit working to identify and foster ways to rebuild the Gulf of Maine and sustain Maine's fishing communities for future generations. For more information about our work, to hear past episodes of Doc Talk, or to make a donation to support our mission, visit mainecoastfishermen.org.